We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about arms control and about the effort to limit the existing numbers of nuclear weapons in the world and also limit the spread of that technology. In 1991, the United States and the Soviet Union signed an agreement that would reduce the numbers of nuclear weapons held by both. That treaty, known as START, expired earlier this month. Both Russia and the United States say that they are close to a new START agreement, and both say that they want to continue to reduce their nuclear stockpiles. We'll be talking about that, about next year's upcoming review of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and we'll also talk about the efforts to limit the spread of weapons to countries, including Iran. And our guest for the program is Leonor Tomero. She's director of nuclear non-proliferation with an organization called the Center for Arms Control and Non-Proliferation based in Washington, D.C. In her work there, she focuses on non-proliferation, on nuclear weapons, nuclear processing, North Korea, and nuclear terrorism. Her academic background is in government, in also national security studies, and in law. Before joining the center, she was president of the Lawyers Alliance for World Security, where she had previously served as director for Western Europe and Latin America. She also worked in Congress on the staffs of Senator Harry Reid and also Representative Shelley Berkeley on issues including nuclear waste, energy, and environmental issues. She is joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions, comments, certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Questions from listeners are welcome. We do ask people to be brief so we can keep moving and get in as many callers as possible, but your questions are welcome. Ms. Tomero, hello.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I am fine. Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Just as a way of starting here, we could spend a lot of time talking about the entire history of arms control involving the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and then after the Soviet Union, Russia. And I do want to talk about where we are now with START. But let us say if I ask this question, at the peak, when the numbers were highest, let's just say we'll talk about nuclear warheads that could be delivered by a missile or dropped by a bomber, the biggest things. Say at the peak, how many warheads did each side have?
Well, I mean, throughout the Cold War, the numbers were quite high, 30,000 weapons. And both sides had the power to destroy the world several times over. And so we have come down from those levels. But I think what's important here is that we're still, I think, in the Cold War era mode, where we still have both between the United States and Russia now, we have over 20,000 weapons. And so we did have the first START treaty, which expired on Saturday, and we're negotiating a follow-on agreement. And we do need to make progress, but I think what's important here for the way forward is we need to really change our mentality and really move away from Cold War era thinking, which resulted in these thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons pointed at each other.
Well, certainly I take your point, and I'm sure that you and other people would make the argument that we could and should significantly limit the numbers that we have now. Some people would say they would envision a world when there weren't any. That may be a long way away, but we could eliminate them further. I guess my purpose in asking the question was at the very least to establish the fact that there has indeed been progress made in reducing the overall number.
Yeah, there has. I think, there was missed opportunities during the Bush administration to make further progress, but there have been reductions throughout the years. We have been making progress, but currently the United States and Russia still have about 20,000 nuclear weapons, which account for over 95% of the nuclear weapons in the world.
Okay.
And so we hope, that in the next few years, we can make much further progress than we've made so far in terms of getting down to numbers that would allow us to maintain, a strong and reliable deterrent, but that would also decrease the liability of having, an excess number of nuclear weapons.
Well, let's talk about START. This was a treaty that it was signed in 1991. It went into effect in 1994. It required both sides to significantly reduce the number of weapons that they had. And the treaty then expired. It expired on the 5th of December. At that point, when it expired, the United States and Russia had been in the process of talking about a new treaty. There had been, in the stories that I read, there had apparently been some hope that maybe they could get an agreement before the expiration. But that didn't happen. So the day came and went. How much of a problem is it that we don't have a treaty now?
Well, the real risk of the treaty expiring without having a new one in hand, I think, really is related to having legally binding verification measures. In the START Treaty, both sides had agreed on legally binding ways that we could verify that each side was actually abiding by their commitment and destroying a certain number of delivery vehicles, which could give us assurance that nuclear warheads were being dismantled. And so with the expiration of the treaty, we've lost these verification measures. And the Bush administration, President Bush, George W. Bush, signed an agreement with Russia in 2002 called the Moscow Treaty, which reduced the level of nuclear warheads, but it didn't come with any legally binding verification. Mm-hmm. So that treaty is in force. So what's important, I think, with a new treaty is to make sure that we can include these verification procedures. And this is part of what's causing delay in the new agreement, is having both sides come together on what the new verification provisions should be. So I think they're making progress. We had hoped that there would be a treaty in hand by the end of the year. It looks like both sides are going to come together again in Geneva in January, and hopefully we'll be able to conclude a treaty in January. Now, once that treaty is signed, the United States Senate still has to give advice and consent to ratification, and that will take several months. So it will probably be, at least half a year before this treaty enters into force, since the Senate has to approve it, and on the Russian side as well, the Duma has to approve it.
Well, let me ask you about that, because also I have read some analysis from both sides here, both the Russian side and the American side. On the side of Russia, some people saying, don't take for granted that the Duma, the parliament, would ratify this. And here in the United States, there are apparently some Republicans in the Senate who are raising some questions about it. So they're saying on both sides, don't take it as a foregone conclusion that there will be easy ratification. What do you think about that?
I think at the end of the day, the treaty will be ratified. I think there's going to be debate and strong views expressed on both sides. I think with respect to the new START agreement, I think we can expect broad bipartisan support. And I don't think, there's a risk that the Senate would vote this down. But I do think what we're going to see is claims and arguments from the Republicans that if we're going to reduce the number of nuclear weapons, then we need to start modernizing our nuclear arsenal. And so, well, you know, whether this means starting to design and produce new nuclear weapons, you know, expanding our nuclear weapons production capabilities. So I think the fight will be on those issues rather than on whether we're going to have a treaty or not.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Leonor Tomero. She's the director of nuclear nonproliferation at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about arms control and efforts to reduce the existing weapons, existing nuclear weapons in the world, and also to limit the spread of the technology. Questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. To go back to the, matter of the inspectors. The as my understanding that under the START Treaty, each country, that is Russia and the United States, was entitled to send 30 inspectors to the other country to make sure that they're complying by the agreement. Now, with the expiration of START on December 5th, does that mean that the inspectors have to pack up and go home?
Well, technically, yes. Each country is not obligated to have inspectors in their country since we no longer have any verification provisions in force. You know, I think part of the concern is that there was a site, a missile production site in Russia called Vatkinsk, which we were inspecting until now, and so these inspectors might be asked to leave. But when we get a new treaty, you know, this site might not even be part of the verification in the new treaty. So so there will be some changes. But I think overall the fact that both sides are negotiating a new treaty, is pretty promising. I'd be a lot more worried if we had the expiration of START and no prospects for a new treaty. I think that would be a much graver concern. So I think the fact that we have a delay of several months, is unfortunate, but I'm, not cause for alarm since both sides are making progress, and it does look like we're going to have a treaty in hand, hopefully, in the next month or so.
There clearly were problems complicating the negotiation of the new treaty between Russia and the United States, and one of them, I don't know if it was the biggest one, but I'm sure it would have to be on the top of the list, was the anti-missile system that had been proposed by President Bush. To be based in part based in Czechoslovakia and part based in Poland. The radar was going to be the radar was going to be in one country and the missiles were going to be in another. And the Russians were extremely unhappy about this. That has now been scrapped by the Obama administration. So no doubt that was one of the problems. Were there some other particular things that were getting in the way of Russia and the United States coming to an agreement about a new START?
I think, there's been a difference on the numbers related to the nuclear warheads and also on the number of delivery vehicles. So by delivery vehicles, I mean the bombers, intercontinental ballistic missiles, or civilian launched ballistic missiles. And so when we're talking about the warheads, the Russians wanted a limit of 1,500 deployed strategic warheads, whereas the United States favored a higher number of 1,675. That relates not to the total number of warheads on each side, but again, as I mentioned, the number of deployed strategic warheads. And on the number of delivery vehicles, Russia favored a lower number, again, 500 delivery vehicles, whereas the U.S. Preferred a higher range, and they were proposing a ceiling of 1,100. So I think what we can expect is probably a compromise and to see something around the 800 level for delivery vehicles. And part of the problem here is that on the U.S. side, there are a number of delivery vehicles that would be counted under this treaty that we don't necessarily use. For example, if a delivery vehicle, for example, a missile silo, has not been destroyed, it still counts under the treaty. So there are a lot of what we call phantom delivery vehicles on the U.S. side, which we don't actually deploy or use, but again, are still counted under the treaty.
You mean that could be a missile silo that once had been a working missile silo, but right now has nothing in it?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't, they haven't poured concrete in or sort of made it so that it couldn't be deployed at some point. A third area, so we have the number of warheads, the number of delivery vehicles, and I think the third area of that has been contentious is, specifics on legally binding verification and, what sites would be covered, what kind of verification would be allowed.
We have a caller. We'd like to encourage other folks, if you have questions, to call in 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. First caller in is Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. You mentioned the Russians have a constituency for modernization of nuclear weapons, but there's certainly a big constituency here in the U.S. It isn't actually mostly from my understanding, isn't actually mostly the military who don't want the bunker buster particularly and don't want to fight on the ground theater nuclear war. So I just wanted you to address those internal dynamics a little bit. There are outside things like the supposed attack on Georgia, which is a little bit of doublespeak since it was really the other way around. But one of the basic points I wanted to bring up is that what the Obama administration put on the table was not very much. I've heard one construction that it really would amount to, a couple of score maybe of weapons and some changes, and it would actually keep the structure of inspection, as you're referring to, in place on an ad hoc basis. So. I know it's very complicated, and I always have more, but could you elucidate on that a bit for me?
Sure. And let me start with the latter part of your question on how much progress this really is. It is incremental progress. This is not, a sea change. But it was prompted by the deadline of the START treaty expiring on December 5th, and so the need for a new treaty. So I think what this did was give us the opportunity to engage in negotiations with Russia on legally binding on a legally binding treaty that would mandate verification, which we haven't done with them in over 10 years, and so. And this was something that Russia wanted. So I think the fact that it's given us the opportunity to reengage with Russia on, meaningful nuclear arms control is very positive. Now, President Obama, in his historic speech in Prague in April earlier this year, mentioned the START treaty, but also said this would only be a first step, and he was committed to further reductions, with a vision towards a world free of nuclear weapons. So we hope that once this treaty is signed, ratified, and enters into force, that the United States and Russia will come together and work on an agreement for further reductions. And usually, a meaningful treaty on reductions takes several years. And they've been working on this new START treaty for only about 8 months. So this has been very quick. But there is, as I said, President Obama has mentioned his intention to work on further reductions with Russia once this incremental step is in place. And I think it is important to reengage with Russia. What we need to be doing is talking to them and having predictability and certainty when it comes to the number of nuclear weapons and what we can expect in the future. I think rules are important, and re-engage them even, in an incremental level has been very important to relaunch the dialogue and rebuild the relationship. You also had a question about U.S. capabilities, which I think is very appropriate and important. And I think this is going to be a topic of debate in the U.S. Senate when the Senate considers the new START agreement. I think there's going to be voices saying we need to increase our nuclear weapons production capabilities. There's a facility at Los Alamos that's being proposed to build new pits, which is the plutonium pits, which is the core of nuclear weapons. So to have a facility that would build 50 to 80 new pits, and there's also a facility proposed at Y-12 in Oak Ridge that would build the same level of number of secondaries, which go into nuclear weapons. So the question is, do we really need these new capabilities, and does this send a mixed signal to non-nuclear weapon states who are looking to the United States to make good on its promise to engage in further disarmament negotiations? And I think bearing on this question of capabilities, there's been a recent report by the JASINs, which are a very prominent and prestigious group of independent scientists that advise the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense on nuclear weapons issues. And they released a report recently saying that there's no cause for concern from our aging nuclear weapons, that the life extension programs that we have to make sure that these weapons remain reliable is working, and that we don't need to be producing new or designing or producing new nuclear weapons in order to mitigate any effects from aging. So that was good news, and so I think this is a very important technical argument in terms of arguing against the need for increasing our nuclear weapons production capability or building new nuclear weapons.
I want to thank the caller and go on to another. We're almost at our midpoint here. Let me again very quickly reintroduce our guest, Leonor Tamaro. She's the director of nuclear nonproliferation at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C., where her work focuses on this issue, that is limiting the spread of nuclear weapons, also nuclear reprocessing, North Korea nuclear terrorism. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Decatur on our line two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I'm concerned about two things. Number one, the cost of our weapons programs. And it seems like to me the most costly delivery system is the nuclear submarines, and also the scariest. And so I'd like to have your comments regarding, are we going to be able to reduce those and or eliminate those in the foreseeable future? Is anybody working on that? And I'll listen.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. There has been some debate among experts on what our deterrent should look like, and whether we should keep our triad, which is the submarines, bombers, and intercontinental ballistic missiles. And so there has been some arguments in favor of scrapping the bombers and just relying on ICBMs and submarines as the most reliable. For now, we could probably expect to just we're going to keep our triad, so keep the bombers, keep the subs, and the ballistic missiles. I think when you look at keeping a reliable deterrent, I think keeping the subs and the ICBMs is probably going to be part of the mix for the next several decades. I think you raise a very good point on cost. We need to be de-emphasizing the role of nuclear weapons and certainly significantly reducing the number of nuclear weapons. I think this is going to go to cost, but I think more important than cost, you know, in terms of strengthening U.S. security, we need to be going to lower numbers. I think these weapons have become a liability. I think having excess number of nuclear weapons in the U.S., but I think more importantly in Russia, you know, increases the risk of nuclear terrorism. If nuclear terrorists was able to get a nuclear weapon, but also it increases the risk of accidental or unauthorized launch of nuclear weapons. So I think decreasing the number certainly should be a priority on security policy.
You know, it wasn't very long ago here on the program we had a conversation about the matter of U.S. nuclear missile-launching submarines. And I guess I was a little bit surprised to learn that, in fact, the amount of time that these submarines spend out on patrol is actually more now than it was during the Cold War. They've shifted their focus from the Atlantic to the Pacific, but it seemed to me rather surprising that now, this long after the Cold War, not only do we still have them, but they're spending more time out there than they were before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think, you know, certainly having submarines is one of the main building blocks of having a reliable deterrent, and so so a lot of money goes into this.
Again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You know, there are five declared nuclear weapon states that signed on to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and the two that we've talked about, and maybe we spend most talking about, Russia and the U.S., they're the ones that have most of the weapons. But Britain, France, and China all have them as well. And as you mentioned, part of the agreement here in the NPT was that countries that didn't already have the weapons, they committed not to developing them. But the other part of the deal was that the states that had nuclear weapons also were supposed to be committing to reducing their stockpiles. And I know that a lot of countries around the world, those who have signed on to the NPT, have sort of said, well, you know, we've done our part. But that these five, U.S., Russia, Britain, France, China, have not. I'm just curious about the three, Britain, France, and China, whether they have made any moves to reduce their numbers of weapons, say, in the last, 20, 30, 40 years?
Well, they do. I mean, they do have a significant lower number of weapons. According to the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Federation of American Scientists, France has about 300, China has about 240, and the UK has about fewer than 200, so about 180 or so. So these are, I mean, this is a fraction, when you compare it to the numbers that Russia and the United States have.
Mm-hmm.
There's concerns that these countries might be modernizing their nuclear weapons, but the point here is that they have much lower levels. And President Obama has made clear that as the United States and Russia make progress and go to lower numbers, the three other nuclear weapon states are going to have to join the negotiations, and eventually you're going to have to bring to the table India, Pakistan, Israel, North Korea, if we're going to have a viable way forward in terms of going to much lower numbers. But I think for right now, you know, the United States and Russia have to lead the way, because we're just at such a higher level in terms of numbers that the other nuclear weapon states will not join in negotiations until they see reductions from the U.S. and Russian sides first.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk. Pardon me, go ahead.
Sure. And I was just going to mention, you talked about the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty,
yes.
Which I think is one of the cornerstones of U.S. and international security, and you did explain it very well. It's a bargain between the five recognized nuclear weapon states, so United States, Russia, France, China, and the United Kingdom on one side, and the rest of the world, about 182 non-nuclear weapon states who have promised never to acquire nuclear weapons. And so this has really been our first line of defense to make sure that nuclear weapons don't spread. And we've had this treaty for about 35 years. In the 60s, there were predictions that there'd be dozens of countries with nuclear weapons, and one of the chief reasons this did not happen was because of the treaty.
Mm-hmm.
So on one side, you have the non-nuclear weapon states that promised never to acquire nuclear weapons, but part of the bargain was that the five nuclear weapon states promised to engage in disarmament negotiations and reduce their level of nuclear weapons and ultimately completely disarm. So that was one of the promises made by the five nuclear states. The other promise was that the nuclear weapon states would cooperate with non-nuclear weapon states to develop nuclear energy. And so this has been a very, very important bargain. And the reason progress by the United States and Russia now on the New START agreement on further reductions in the number of nuclear weapons, but also on, for example, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which we hope will come up next year and that the Senate will consider it and approve this treaty. The reason these are so important is that the rest of the world, these 102 non-nuclear weapon states, are going to be looking for a signal and evidence of good faith progress by the nuclear weapon states. And in fact, there's a conference that's going to gather 189 countries to come together and assess the viability and health of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty in May of 2010. Looking for, I think implementing the Obama administration's agenda on a New START agreement, on starting negotiations for further reductions, on getting a comprehensive test ban treaty passed are really going to be very important signals to the rest of the world on whether this treaty, which has been, again, our first line of defense against the spread of nuclear weapons, can remain viable in the next few years, in the next decade.
Yeah, and that's a regular, every 5 years.
Yes,
that happens,
right.
the review of the treaty.
Right.
Well, I have another caller here I want to get to. They're in Effingham on our line four. Let's go there. Hello.
Yes, I have two questions. Could your guest explain what she means by nuclear terrorism?
Did I explain
what you mean by the
nuclear terrorism?
Nuclear terrorism.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's an increased risk now versus the Cold War that terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda might be able to either steal a nuclear weapon from Russia, but more likely that they'd be able to get the material needed to make a nuclear weapon. So to either acquire the highly enriched uranium or the plutonium. You really don't need that much material to make a crude nuclear weapon. You need about 25 kilograms of highly enriched uranium and about 8 kilograms of plutonium. The risk is that if terrorists were able to acquire this material, and they had sufficient knowledge, both, physics, chemistry, engineering, et cetera, that they'd be able to fashion a very crude nuclear weapon and attack a city in the United States.
So we're back to the suitcase bomb.
Yeah, I think this is certainly, I think, one of the gravest threats looming. I think that the threat of a nuclear attack by a terrorist group is one, and the second one is the acquisition of nuclear weapons by other countries.
Well, I think Mr. Bush has invented that one out of whole cloth. My second question is, why did you leave out Pakistan as a nuclear power?
Oh, I'm sorry. That was just an oversight. Yeah.
Okay.
The countries that are not part of the Nuclear non-proliferation treaty are India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. And of course, India, Pakistan, Israel have never been part of the treaty. North Korea was part of the treaty, but that pulled out of the treaty in 2003 and has been developing.
Well, with Pakistan, is that why George Bush II offered nuclear materials and idea and technology to India, which he, you know, that was a big thing.
Right. Yeah. And that was something. I think that was a very, very controversial agreement, and an agreement that significantly undermined the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Yes.
Part of the benefits for the non-nuclear weapon states in good standing under the treaty is that they are allowed to engage in nuclear cooperation agreements.
My last thing is, if I were an Iranian, which formerly in Iraq, the U.S. had Israel bomb what they thought was a nuclear facility in Iraq. If I were an Iranian or lived in that part of the Middle East, and all the flap about Iran acquiring the nuclear weapons, and the thing that's always missing is Israel, whom the U.S. gifted military might to some time ago. And I've heard in recent news that they, when the U.S. says it to Israel, get Iran, they will. That those penetrating shells and bombs that maybe the U.S. would drop, or it's simpler to have the Israelis, who is an American stooge in the Middle East. If I lived in that part of the world, I would be very uncomfortable. It's like having a bully telling another bully what to do and how to do it, which, you know, defies any sort of humanity about the current situation of this world. And to think that we're going to somehow survive all this and the patriarchal ideas that have gotten us where we are and about to destroy us, I'm very nervous about all that, for one. And if I, again, were an Asian or an Arab, I would be unable to sleep, I think. Thank you.
And I think you refer to, you know, one of the gravest problems in international security is in the Middle East, of course, and Northeast Asia, and, the growing and escalating problem with Iran's nuclear weapon, and the risk if Iran continues on this path of you know, possibly acquiring a nuclear weapons capability, you know, what the results might be. You know, I think we do have to be very worried, and I think Iran is going to be a critical challenge for the continued viability of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and whether we can resolve this problem diplomatically and successfully. You know, a lot hinges on the resolution of this problem. Iran has consistently talked about Israel as being a problem, and Israel needing to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So, you know, I think these are all important points, and you know, all sides are going to have to come to the table. We're going to have to resolve the concerns over Iran's nuclear program, and then we're going to have, you know, at some point, if we're going to have a viable resolution, Israel will have to come to the table. But I think what's dangerous in terms of turning this on its head, you know, the solution is not for more countries to have more nuclear weapons. You know, if we do not resolve the problem in Iran, I think the Arab states will become increasingly concerned and worried about their security and might opt to develop a nuclear weapons capability themselves. And so you might end up with several more countries in the region, you know, able to make a nuclear weapon, you know, within a few months if they have the materials. So this is a very important point, and I think an important challenge for the Obama administration, and you know, we're going to have some kind of resolution in the next few years. The Obama administration, I think, has put a great emphasis on trying to find a diplomatic solution and, you know, to move away from the option of military intervention, which I think would only increase the rate at which Iran might be seeking a nuclear weapon. So we do need a diplomatic resolution, and you know, this is going to be critical in the next year or two.
This gets me to something that I wanted to ask you about. Back in the spring, Mohammed Al-Baradei, who recently retired as the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, he apparently said that he was worried that we were on the brink of a new era of proliferation that would involve what he called virtual nuclear weapon states. And by that, he meant states that can produce material for bombs and have the technical capability to build bombs, but stop just short of actually doing it, actually building the weapons. And he said he was afraid that in the relative near future, there might be as many as 10 or 20 countries like that. And I don't recall him mentioning specific countries, but I'm sure that he would be thinking of other countries in the Middle East certainly would have the resources to do it if they chose. And I wonder what you think about that, and do you in fact think that he's right?
Yeah, I do think that this is really going to be, I think the next few years, maybe the next decade, is going to be a real turning point. I think we're on the verge of, especially I think if we do not solve the Iran problem, an increasing number of countries are going to opt to acquire either uranium enrichment capabilities or plutonium reprocessing. And so enrichment, of course, would give countries the ability to produce highly enriched uranium, or if they developed reprocessing facilities, which extracts plutonium from nuclear waste, you're able to then stockpile plutonium that you could then use to make nuclear weapons. And both, you know, both these technologies are being used for so-called, you know, peaceful purposes. You need an enrichment plant to be able to make fuel for nuclear power plants. And there's really no way around that in terms of getting the fuel for nuclear power plants for, you know, the kind of nuclear power plants that the United States uses, which are the light water reactors. You know, several countries, for example, Japan, the United Kingdom, Russia, France, use reprocessing. So they extract the plutonium from the nuclear waste and use some of this plutonium back in nuclear reactors. Now, you do not need reprocessing in the nuclear fuel cycle. And I think what we should be doing is moving away towards a ban on reprocessing. And in terms of enrichment, I think, you know, the solution is going to be having facilities that are multilateral facilities. So you don't have national enrichment facilities. Again, you know, I think this might be down the line, but we're going to have to address these capabilities. And I think the fact that an increasing number of countries have expressed interest in acquiring these facilities, you know, might be very, very dangerous. You have countries, for example, in the context of the debate on creating a fuel bank where supplier countries would enrich uranium and sell it to recipient countries. So you have South Africa and Canada and other countries that have come forward saying, well, maybe they might be interested in enriching uranium. And on the other side, on reprocessing, again, you've got several countries that have come forward. For example, South Korea is now very interested in reprocessing. And so, you know, I think the danger in terms of proliferation, you know, might be that we're going to have this new wave of proliferation of nuclear weapons, nuclear weapons material production technologies that might spread.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour, Focus 5-8, is Leonard Tamero. She's director of nuclear nonproliferation at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. We have about 6-7 minutes left and several callers, and we'll try to get as many as we can. The first here in line is Champagne and Line 1. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
I began listening a little bit too late, so I hope I'm not misunderstanding anything. There was a caller who got me to call you, and it's amazing how your guest today is suggesting again and again that all these Al-Qaeda terrorists in Afghanistan in those caves are capable of developing nuclear weapons, and they can smuggle it in America, and they can bomb everybody and everything. At the time, several years ago, when again they attacked New York and the Pentagon, the number of Al-Qaeda was, I think, 1,200 people, unknown small terrorist cell somewhere over there in Asia, and then nobody knew about it, and all of a sudden, heroes, and we still people like your guest today suggesting that they're capable of overwhelming and destroying a $1 trillion per year military power like United States. Why we do not put our military in the border so we can be protected? And specialists and scientists are saying that. Again, the same lies about Saddam in Iraq, and again, now Iran has capability, which they don't have it. And the only country the last 20, 30, 40 years had developed nuclear weapons was with help from the West, and especially from Washington and American government and corporations. Last year, Cheney gave Chinese government 3 nuclear reactors, the same with India, Pakistan. Without, and even big, capable countries like those cannot develop on their own nuclear weapons. How about Bin Laden, who, of course, is dead the last several years, running in those caves with kidney dialysis and et cetera. But how those terrorists, 1,200, can be in so much danger that we have to, of course, destroy our...
Yeah, you put a lot on the table there, and we're getting short on time, and I want to get the guest to comment. I'm not sure what of that you would like to take. I suppose the big issue is, well, is it? Do you really think that it's that an organization like Al-Qaeda would, in fact, have the technical capability, the knowledge, the facilities, and so forth, to actually manufacture a nuclear weapon?
Yeah, I think this is a very real danger, I'm not just the one saying this. For example, former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, said in 2004 that there was a 50% chance that a terrorist group might acquire and detonate a nuclear weapon somewhere in the world by the end of the decade, is what he said. For example, Dr. Matthew Bunn at Harvard in Managing the Atom has also been tracking very carefully the progress made in securing fissile material precisely because of the risk that terrorists might, if they're able to acquire or steal or divert vulnerable bomb-grade material, that they'd be well on their way to be able to make a nuclear weapon. The technology is... The technology is available on the internet. So the gun barrel technology to make a crude nuclear weapon, all you need is 2 pieces of highly enriched uranium. If you're able to slam them together, you have yourself a crude nuclear weapon that could kill, thousands or hundreds of thousands of people if you detonate it in a densely populated city. And at the same time, we know that Al-Qaeda has said that they are looking to acquire a nuclear weapon and that they would want to kill 3 million Americans, including women and children and civilians. And so I think this is a very real threat. The caller mentioned the idea of, well, why don't we put more military at the border. You know, the problem is the problem of detecting every border crossing and making sure that we have the technology to detect nuclear smuggling has been a very, very tall order. And I think, you know, the most promising solution is really to secure this material at the source. So secure this material where it's vulnerable, where it's been stored or it's being produced around the world. Most of the facilities and most of the material is in Russia. And we have been, the U.S. government has been, for about 15 years, since the end of the Cold War, helping Russia to secure this material and make sure it's accounted for. And what we just need to do is, I think, accelerate these efforts and at the same time improve our detection capability. And President Obama has made this one of his priorities. He has said during the campaign and since he's been elected that his plan is to secure vulnerable fissile material within 4 years, and he's called a summit in Washington that will bring together between 30 and 40 countries to come together and talk about the risk of nuclear terrorism and the need to secure this material, and that the United States cannot do this alone. It really has to be a cooperative effort. I think this is one of the priorities, and you know, it's a race against the clock, is making sure that we can secure this material before it's stolen. And you do not need a missile to deliver a nuclear weapon. I think if a terrorist group was able to acquire the material and it was able to fashion a crude nuclear weapon, you could put it on a boat and drive it up to a harbor. You wouldn't need to load this onto a missile, you know, which of course would be much harder and much, much more expensive.
We are going to have to stop. We are here at the end of the time. My apologies. We have a couple of people that we can't take. I'm sure, though, it's an issue we'll come back to again. In the meantime, if you're interested in reading more on this issue, you might look for the website of the organization here that we've been talking about, the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. They're based in Washington, D.C. You can find them on the web. And our guest this morning, Leonor Tamero, is the Director of Nuclear Nonproliferation at the center. And Ms. Tamero, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.